The theme of our reading today is really one of the most interesting and important on the spiritual path, and it's the word surrender. It's a complicated word, and Swamiji at different times has refrained from using it. Of course, he wrote this commentary, so he obviously doesn't always refrain from using it. He said he's never liked the word all that much because surrender implies that your back is against the wall and the only reason you're doing it is because you have no choice. And if you could see a little bit of a mouse hole out, you would take it. I mean, most people don't think of it in a positive light. Also, it implies that you've been overpowered and therefore it's a sign of weakness. You know, Americans were horrified at the end of the war with Japan. How many Japanese felt that it was so dishonorable to have to be defeated that they'd rather commit suicide, which on one hand seems a bit extreme, but you also understand the sense of honor behind that. I suspect suicide in that case was a matter of what was really motivating the individuals. Karma is always individual, even though there's certain patterns, suicide being not a very positive step to take. Swamiji, when asked, said it depends a great deal on why you do it. But the point being about the word surrender, that we have to really come into some understanding of what this really means in order to practice it properly. I was asked recently, I received a letter from someone and they asked me the question, the same question. He was saying he has no sense of any personal form of God. This particular man was writing, doesn't feel mother or father, and he doesn't really know what he's surrendering to, and it doesn't feel at all inspiring to him to think like that. So I was trying to come at it from another angle, and what we have to understand at all times, it's not so much what we're surrendering to, it's what we ourselves are giving up. It's like when you surrender, you turn over the territory. You've owned it, and now you give it to someone else. When Lee and Grant met at the Fort of Appomattox, you know, the South ceased to be a separate country, and the South had to come back into the Union. They had to surrender that independence, and it was less about giving it over to the North as it was about no longer owning it for themselves. Now, of course, they had definitely been roundly defeated. And the end of the Civil War in America is what gives surrender a bad name. And a lot of energy in among Southerners, probably not so much anymore, but for many, many, many decades afterwards, they never really did surrender. They held on to the principles and the ideas and the thought that something had been done against them. And so even if they were forced to acquiesce, any reality to what they had done was not there. And this is a salutary lesson for us if we're thinking about surrender in a spiritual sense. When I was growing up, when I look back upon it, I realized that because of past life experience, I was born with many, many yogic attitudes, which I just sort of figured out and made my own personal philosophy more or less, or my own abject and utter confusion at the world that I found myself in, and the inability, my inability to relate to any of it. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I was saying, honestly, I can't think of one thing I learned in school, except to add and subtract, and you know, and to read. Well, I could read before I went to school, so they never taught me that. But in all my years of schooling, which was up through 1 year of college, I can't think of anything I learned that was actually useful to me. I had one good teacher in high school, and I sort of remember his vibration. But I mean, that's pretty pathetic, really, when you think about it, and is a clarion call for Living Wisdom School, but that's a different issue. But when I look back on my whole life from the perspective of self-realization, which I discovered when I was just barely 19, just before I was 19, and it was as soon as I saw the principles of self-realization in Sanatana Dharma, which is the essence of what is offered here, I instantly recognized it. I just knew it. And of course, this is all past lives. But it was like all the confusion of my young life just clicked into place. It's like, oh, I wasn't really confused. I just didn't have any vocabulary. And what I began to realize, the older I got and the more I understood it, is what I suffered from was a state of confinement. I mean, nobody in my life would ever have said that to me, but I felt so confined. Somehow there was this feeling inside of tremendous potential. And it would be articulated in terms of, oh, your SAT scores are high, you can go to a really fine college, you have a logical mind, you could be a lawyer, you know, you're a nice person, you could be a doctor. Of course, I could always be a PhD somewhere. I mean, there was just all these options. But every one of them sort of took the confinement from here to here, as far as I could see. And I was confused because it wasn't like those activities were not worthwhile. You know, I wasn't so cynical that I thought it wasn't worth doing, but I could see that it wasn't going to solve the essential problem that I had, which is that there was, is, this enormous potential, this potential without edges. And merely training myself to do this, adding another title, having this be my self-definition, which of course these are words that came later, was not going to really solve that problem. The problem was a lack of standing somewhere that really had power. Do you understand what I mean? Because even if, okay, I'm a big academic or I'm a big doctor or I'm a wealthy this or a wealthy that, it's the sheer vulnerability of it is so self-evident, isn't it? Just the slightest change. Just the slightest change. Right now we have a whole generation of people who've been told if they work hard and go to college and get their degrees and so on, then they'll get the American dream. And they're all graduating. And if they don't know how to write computer code, they're just out on the streets. I mean, the unemployment among young people is a very serious issue. I know I was talking to a young man and he happens to have found his way into a good profession. He has four friends, all with exactly the same education as him, all of whom are just being underutilized. That's the underemployed is the word that we use so that we don't have to actually say what's happening. But it's not, it's a promise that the world, who's going to keep that? We were very confident in America that our prosperity would never end, that real estate prices would never go down. We just knew it. But we didn't take into account greed and avarice and, you know, buying off of politicians and changing of laws. And we haven't ever even been physically attacked except once on our soil here, twice if you count Pearl Harbor. You know, so many things. Right after 9/11, I went over to the Palo Alto City Hall area and there was a big service right after 9/11. And one of the people who spoke was a student from the Middle East at Stanford University. Just a young man, looks like everybody else around here. He stood up to speak, and he said, well, the first bomb attack came when I was 6 years old. And then he proceeded to describe his childhood, which is wherever he had lived, and now I don't remember anymore, he'd been subject to, you know, either terrorist attacks or civil wars where he lived or attacks from the outside, and you know, just the happy childhood that so many of us enjoyed, he'd never enjoyed that. I mean, I can go on and on and on. We all know untimely death, accidents, suicides, murder, violence, crime, economic change, war, just like this. You know, how are we going to protect ourselves from any of that? And where does this sense of insecurity come from? We think it comes from not being nurtured as a child. I was listening to a man on the radio who started a very successful startup company, and he was talking about how he had to learn to work. He said, I'm of the generation, I love the way he put this, I'm of the generation that got trophies for everything. Meaning we were so concerned about their poor self-esteem that we just gave them a trophy whether they did well or not. You know, just trying to help them somehow overcome this all-pervasive underlying sense of insecurity which every one of us suffers from, whether it's lack of fulfillment or insecurity. And we can run huge, and we have huge psychological studies about why we feel this way and so on and so on. I mean, amazing things that we pay money for. You know, they're just, anyway, there's a point even going there. When I was 20, I had a job. I'm going to go there. When I was 20, I had a job. I lived in this area at that time. This seems to have been my karmic home for a long time, long before Ananda, or a little before Ananda, before I met Swami. And I had a job at what was called then SRI, Stanford Research Institute. I was a temp worker. I was typing. I was typing a document that said top secret on it, top secret. I was a temp worker. And it was a report of somebody who had, this was during the Vietnam War, somebody had been paid by somebody to go to Vietnam and do a door-to-door survey of which government they preferred, the communists or the non-communists. And there were two problems with the study, which they admitted. One, there was a war going on, and so you couldn't really, you know, your sample was a little random. The other problem was that it was culturally impossible for a Vietnamese person to answer your question in a way that didn't please you. So here we are. So no matter, you know, they would try to gauge which side of the question you were on, and then they would answer the question accordingly because it was part of their culture to be agreeable. You didn't want to contradict a stranger. You didn't want to disappoint him. And I'm typing this top secret like this, and I'm just thinking, you know, I'm already on the spiritual path. I haven't yet met Swami. And my sense what do you want to think? Desperate fear and insecurity is growing by the moment. You know, what kind of a world am I entering into? Now, what people do in a state like this is we become cynical. You become cynical, you drink, you become rude, you just become obnoxious. You become, in my particular social milieu, is that how you say the word? Whatever that word is, my group. Anyway, we became intellectual snobs. That's what we did. We just became very superior to everyone else. We went out and got our big degrees, and then we sat around our living rooms and talked about how stupid everyone else is. My dear uncle, God bless his soul, he's now in the astral world. He was 96 when he died. He was always the smartest guy in the room, and he really was. He was a really, really, really smart guy. And he really, really, really enjoyed being really, really, really smart. And he also enjoyed the fact that a lot of people were less smart than he. He had a very good heart. This was just a bad habit that was, you know, inculcated in him. And then in his later years, he lost his mental acuity. But he didn't lose his snobism, which would have been amusing. But it was spiritually very stimulating to me to be with him because he was the exact epitome of, you know how your mother would say, if you make a face like that, someday your face is going to get stuck like that. Well, he thought those thoughts so many times that his poor little mind got stuck there. So even when he didn't have the ability anymore, he loved to relive the incidences of when he'd been the smartest guy in the room. And he would tell them to me over and over again as older people do. You know, they just forget. They've told you the story, so they tell you again. And in all the stories, he would be very righteously indignant. He would be very angry about everybody else's stupidity. And at one point, I said to him, after we'd finished the story for the 100th time, I said, Uncle Ted, do you really enjoy remembering all the times that you were angry about something? Oh, yes, he said, just like that. Oh, yes. You know, this is who he was, and this is who he wanted to be. All I could think was, God, spare me. You know, just spare me. He was a good man in many other ways. He had a wonderful marriage, a beautiful wife. He did many, many good things. This was just one part of him. But you see, this is how we cope. We have to find some way in which we can hold on. But underneath it, you know, that's where the rigidity comes from. He was so fanatical in that attitude because underneath it, he didn't have any faith in God. He didn't have any faith in any reality except that power of his own mind. Wow, that's really scary. That's really scary. So when we come back to this question of surrender, the question is, what are we giving up? We make such a big deal about not wanting to surrender, but what are we giving up? What territory are we handing over? When I found the spiritual path, when it really occurred to me for the first time, that this dim sense I had that there might be a greater reality was not just a dream, but that thousands and thousands of people and ancient traditions asserted that, in fact, you know, we are not just this isolated little unit of consciousness sort of moving through this big world trying to establish itself strongly enough. You know, buy enough acreage around your house so there'll never be any bad neighbors. You know, just all these different ways that we work on it. But we're not. And just the littlest bit of expanded awareness just makes that so true. You know, one unique night under a starry sky, one camping trip up into the high country, one moment when your firstborn, you know, cries and reaches up and holds your hand, just all of a sudden you realize that we are part of a reality that we can barely imagine, literally barely imagine. And then we suddenly discover that this profound and terrifying insecurity has been based on a real fact. And that fact is that we are not in charge. But then we come to the second part of it, because we have to figure out, what are we surrendering to? And if we're fortunate, and that fortunate is an interesting word, because it's a fortunate that comes to us slowly by our own willingness to participate in it. Every week we read the Festival of Light, and it's this repeating ritual that you hear the words over and over again. And Swamiji wrote that because he felt it was extremely important for us to hear the essence of our teaching again and again and again and again, because the power of what we're trying to understand here can be easily articulated, but the grip that this singularity and this false belief that I have to hold on tight, that my power comes from me, you know, and we're trained, as I say, especially in this culture, to really believe that my power comes from me, from my brain, from my training, from my status, from my money, from my attractiveness. You know, women are really trained to think that it comes from their attractiveness. I have a friend who was, she was really, really beautiful when she was young. And she told me that it was the curse of her life, not for the obvious reasons, because she was very restrained. She didn't misuse it that way. But she said it made her absolutely lazy, was the word she used, because all she had to do was just walk into a room and a great deal would happen around her. And she said she just got in the habit of just sitting there. All she had to do was just sit there behind her face, and everyone would respond to her. You know, of course, cruel and terrible things happen to women as they grow older, especially women who are very beautiful when they're young. It's a very odd sort of quirk that God plays. And she herself repudiated it at a certain point. And in a very odd sort of way, she had the same features, but she made herself ordinary looking because she just was so tired of being beautiful. Isn't that odd? You know, but this grip that we have on the belief that it comes from what we look like and what we know and how we can influence and how we can organize and how we can plan it just so, that's a very, very hard reality to let go of. But that's what you're surrendering. We're surrendering the false belief that I am in charge. And if... I was starting to say about the Festival of Light. Swamiji wanted this repeated and repeated to us because it has to just go, it's like a dripping water. It's like the Grand Canyon. It just has to be little by little by little by little, just furrowing through the stone-hard quality. And the word for it is of our fear, because that's the basis of all of it. You know, it's not ill will, it's not dislike, it's anything, it's just fear. What will happen if I let go? This is how I've been trained. This is what everyone has told me. And then comes, what am I opening to? What am I opening to? And in the Festival of Light, we have this story. The little bird is sent out by God, and he's a part of all that is, and he's told to participate in the whole of creation because you are a part of all that is. That's what he says. But the bird kind of tries it out a little bit, just like all the adolescents that we see around us trying it out, trying on different personalities. Today I'm a tough guy, tomorrow I'm a softie, today I'm gothic, the next day I'm a, you know, retrograde, retro hippie, you know. It's just like one of my friends who was the principal of a high school, he said, the thing about teenagers is they are, and appropriately, trying on different personalities, but their memories are short, so whichever one they're wearing is all that's ever been. And you have to take it completely seriously as it appears to you. If you refer to the past or the future, well, you lose all credibility in the instant like that. So the little bird gets out there and he starts discovering a fact. And it is a fact that we can influence things by our own will. It's not like we're passive in this. So he does things and he realizes, oh, if I grab, I get more. And if I hoard, I seem to have more. And then if I grab a little more and stuff it in, I seem to have more. I mean, it's a subtle game. If it were simple, we'd figure it out right away. It's very subtle. So the bird keeps testing this. And in our little allegory, it says, he believed in this. What else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? It's just another way of saying, I'm separate. I'm not part of the whole. I'm separate. What else is wisdom except to emphasize that separateness? And then it says, and then he clung to this thought, even though repeatedly he lost all he had. Even though time after time after time after time, the inevitable vulnerability of trying to declare a reality that isn't there. That's the whole problem with it, you see. It's just not there. We are a part of all that is. Our power is not created by us. Comes from a flow, a relationship, a participation, an embracing, an opening. The bird tries and tries and tries and tries. And finally, he's suffered enough. It's just as simple as that. It's not really good luck or good fortune or even good karma in a certain sense to open to this idea. It's because we've suffered enough. We've had it. I said to Swamiji, Swamiji, I was born with such an intense desire to have a different life and to not get trapped in what just looked to me like a just dead-end realities. And I said, but I've had a completely privileged existence and no bad thing has ever happened to me. But he just looked at me and he said, past lives, you know, been there, done that. I'm sure all of you have the same experience. We can tap into just levels of disappointment, levels of fear, levels of pain that we don't know where they come from. You know, you have no idea where it comes from. It's attached to nothing, except it's attached to all those incarnations where we were like that little bird, even though repeatedly we lost everything we had. And then finally, you sort of ungrip yourself like this. I had a high fever once, very high fever. And I was under the delusion that if I didn't hold my body like this, I lay in the fetal position for I don't really know how long, like this, because I was convinced that if I relaxed, that the four points of my body would split apart. You know, it was a very high fever. Complete. And then as the fever began to come down, I began to think that many times in my life I have not been curled up like this. And therefore, it's probable that if I open up, I'm not going to fly apart. So very, very slowly, I sort of opened up and was relieved to discover that I was still intact. But isn't that just exactly what it is for us? When we learn to love, when we learn to give, a friend of mine was very generous, and I guess it was not his habit to be generous. That feels good, he said. I think I'll do it again. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good thing. Let's start, like, thinking like that. But what else is wisdom if to keep what is mine for myself? And so we get generous with our stuff, we get generous with our time, but how generous are we really with our trust, with our openness, with our belief, with our willingness to act on that simple truth? And that this is the whole spiritual path. And the fun of it, you see, is it just never grows boring because there's always another step. There's always another step. There's always a little more. there's always just a little piece of us that can just open up and say, what am I protecting? Why do I really want to keep this? Richard Bach, the modern writer, he had a great statement. He said, fight for your delusions, and here's the reward. You get to keep them. You know? So we have to ask ourselves, what am I protecting? And how long do I want to be this way? A friend of mine recently went through a very difficult test, and she's of my generation. And she was struggling, but she's really a fighter, and she was really going through it. And I said, you're 70 years old. Do you want to die this way? And it's really asking ourselves whether you're 20. I'm 20 years old. Do I want to spend the rest of my life this way? I'm 70. Do I want to die this way? No, we don't. We need to cultivate and practice. And, of course, there's many other things that can be said now about how. But once we think of why and what we're trying to do, even that sincere desire, God will show you. Pray deeply. Pray deeply for the courage, for the trust and the grace and the faith. And you take one tiny step toward God and He rushes out to shower you with blessings. You see, that's part of what we begin to know. Then there's no question of trust or question of surrender. It's like love itself just opens your arm. You don't have to try to surrender to your beloved. You just love. That's where it comes from. God bless you.